Welcome to Dear Prudence. I'm your Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Today, we'll be discussing an interracial couple's debate over African-centered home decor, how to cope with homesickness for a place you don't actually want to live, and whether it's fair to cut off an ex. Joining me today is Michael Arsenault. He's the author of I Can't Date Jesus and I Don't Want to Die Poor. His brand new essay collection, I Finally Bought Some Jordans, will be available on March 12th. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I really, really appreciate you coming on. And I'm dying to ask you, before we get started, for one piece of unsolicited advice.
Call your mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Talk about whatever. I didn't mean to start all morbid, but I see sometimes people complain. You know, my mom bugs me about this all day, or my dad texts me about nothing, like mm-hmm. the weather and yada yada. Appreciate that. I know it's a cliche, but you truly don't know how much time you have. So call your mom.
Oh my God, you're the first person to get me crying off of this question. I immediately got choked up. That's amazing advice. Thank you for it. Michael and I will dive into your questions after a short break. Can't get enough Dear Prudence? Then you should definitely join Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. You'll get to hear me answer an extra question every week just for members. With your subscription, you get ad-free listening across the Slate network and unlimited reading on the Slate site, including all Dear Prudence columns, past and present. Go to slate.com/prudyplus to sign up. It's just $15 for your first 3 months. Again, that's slate.com/prudyplus. Welcome back. You're listening to Dear Prudence, and I'm here with Michael Arsenault. Let's get started with our first letter. It's titled Design Disaster.
My fiance and I have just moved in together and are having issues with decorating. I'm white, but my fiance is black and knows some of his family's heritage. We both have decorating styles that overlap in some areas and not at all in others. There's one thing I particularly don't like, and it's when items look like they were crafted or handmade. I prefer a more modern and sleek look for my home. I'm a major homebody and have a very strong need for a comfortable space. My fiancé understands that, and we agree on big things, like architectural style and furniture style, but the one thing we can't agree on is his African-centered decor, including things he brought back from when we were living separately. He didn't seem to have that much, but now that we've moved in, there's a lot more than I realized. I'm having real trouble fitting this into the house. My fiancé asked me what I would be comfortable with. I told him I would be fine putting any African-centered decor that fits into the home style in any room, but that I wanted the majority of it in the basement, which is primarily his space and his office. He said that it's not enough space because he wants his office to look professional, which I think is demonstrative that he understands his decor is a very specific style that is not for everybody. He says that he wants more of it throughout the house. I'm feeling really bad right now because I think I'm being very reasonable. We have a few small things throughout the house right now, but he still has several boxes of items stored in the basement. My fiancé told me that he was hoping to use the majority of the items when he moved from a one-bedroom apartment into a three-bedroom house. I feel like if these things weren't so important to his background, I wouldn't feel as bad, but this isn't just a difference between two design styles. My fiancé has a huge connection to these items. I was hoping to get your input and maybe some perspective on this.
So, Michael, I'm pretty sure we're talking about masks, right? I'm imagining a lot of masks. And,
yes.
And I'm picturing baskets, too.
Yes.
Not like couches.
No.
Nothing big. Just sort of accessories.
Yeah. My immediate thought when I read this and heard it was, you really should answer this, solve this problem as best as possible, because this is probably going to be the rest of your life, particularly the template with your children and other decisions. I actually understand the idea of like, oh, you have way more stuff than I thought you did.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the comment that, well, I said you could put your things everywhere, but actually keep most of it in the basement. And I mm-hmm. found those two things in conflict. Personally, I get it. Everybody has specific aesthetics and maybe there is too much. But I think if he's saying that he really would like to see more of things that speak to him sprinkled across the house, there needs to be more of an effort to make a compromise.
Right.
And maybe they both can, in that, like, some of that stuff could possibly go to storage or be discarded. But I think it doesn't sound as if there's as much around the house as it seems. And the same can be said about the actual effort to kind of accommodate that. I think there needs to be more of an effort to kind of find a middle ground. Even if it's not your personal aesthetic, I feel like relations about compromise, you're talking about marriage, you have cultural differences. This is going to reiterate in terms of like how you raise your children, all those types of things. So I just think try to compromise better now, because this will save you from a lot of headaches and potentially divorce fees in the future.
I completely agree. On a practical level, I think there are solutions. There are creative ways to combine design styles. So there's probably a way to combine sleek and modern and African. Look up African modern decor on Pinterest. There are some ideas there. You're saying everything looks handmade, but I'm sure some of it is metal or sleek black wood. You could potentially put it all on one wall. You could frame stuff. I also think there may be a way to sort through, like you suggested, get rid of some stuff and keep other stuff based on what's actually authentic, what's attached to a special memory from travel, what's closely tied to his specific heritage versus what's the stuff that every tourist who goes to any African country buys that may or may not be made in China. So maybe just a little bit of investigation into what's really special. That said, there are layers here.
Yes.
And the actual decor is only the very top layer. Exactly like you said, Michael, this is going to continue to come up. I think it's healthy that the letter writer is feeling sensitive about this because of the racial and cultural undertones.
Yes.
I think if her partner had a bunch of sports paraphernalia, she would feel comfortable saying, you know what, no, we're not doing that. This is going to continue to come up, and you have to have the framework and the tools to talk about the sensitivity around the cultural clash and the racial dynamics, not just the top layer, which is the stuff. Can't you see this coming up if they have a child and the child wants to get her hair braided? And this letter writer is going, I've always hated braids. It's just a thing for me. I never put my hair in a French braid. I don't like a braid. Okay, well, it's not going to be about the braid. It's going to be about the significance racially and culturally of the hairstyle. What if he wants to put the child in a predominantly black or diverse school? And she's going, well, I just hate charter schools. I don't believe in them. You're going to need to be able to dig past that and talk about his values and why he cares about this thing. And your values matter too. It's not just the black person's values who matter, but you have to be able to discuss the actual clash that's happening, not the superficial stuff that's rising to the surface.
Yes, because I do like the letter writer's sensitivity to understanding that there is a cultural attachment to a lot of this. And so there needs to be some awareness. But to your point, when you enter relationships with someone different than you, then there has to also not only be compromised, but maybe an embrace of some of those differences, because you are committing yourself to this relationship. So you're going to have to open your mind just a wee bit more. Otherwise, I can hear the argument about where the child would go to school and no, not that dress, not this hair. No.
You want to develop a practice of saying, okay, this is sensitive because there's a race piece of this. And I don't want to step on your toes in that way, but here are my preferences. I think she should ask him more questions.
Yes.
Tell me about your attachment to these items. What do they mean to you? How do they contribute to what you always imagined your home looking like? And how sensitive are you about that? What are the emotions that come up when you see these items? What are the emotions that come up when you think about not seeing these items? Whatever it is, it can't be tiptoed around.
Yeah, and this feels a little bit of a tiptoe, well-meaning, but like you need to get to see if this union can work. It's either a beautiful Mariah Carey or it's going to be a mess. Love Mariah.
We do. And yeah, at the end of the day, you want your home to be a place that's peaceful and meaningful to both of you.
Right.
And you want your life to be a place that's peaceful and meaningful to both of you. And Michael, it's exactly what you said in the beginning. These things start to build up. And that's what you start hearing about when people start explaining their divorce. She didn't care about how I felt. You know, he was trying to walk all over me with his stuff. You can't talk past each other. It's just some baskets and some masks. I know you think it's just about home decor, and on some level it is, but it's worth using this as practice to talk about your values, put it right on the table that there are going to be some hard things about being in an interracial relationship. Talk about your fears, the kind of person you want to be, the kind of person he wants to be. With that, our next question is titled Homesick All the Time.
How do I beat homesickness? I have big, complicated feelings about the place I grew up in, and I miss it with weird pangs at least once a week. I cry about it at least once a month, and I'm 30. I've lived in my current major metro and have friendships and work and connections here for about 8 years, and I love many things about it. But everywhere I've lived as an adult, I get homesick for the state I grew up in, which is separate from missing my family, who have mostly left to find work. I grew up in a beautiful rural place with a distinctive culture and leftist political vibe that leans toward earnestness and zaniness. There are cultural patterns and joy I've never found anywhere else. It has basically no stable, good-paying work for people my age. You either scrape by in tourism or agriculture, and usually a combination of three jobs. Internet access is hilariously spotty. Access to medical care is shockingly bad, and the opioid epidemic and overdose deaths have rippled through the lives of nearly everyone I grew up with. I experienced the worst open homophobia of my life there in 2020. If you need something, you better hope you're self-reliant or have a good relationship with neighbors who can help, because resources are thin. But people are creative about these problems and prioritize getting things done quietly but constantly. People don't have money, but they do have access to an interest in ideas, and there's less of a sense that an education or political theory are a class thing. I've lived there off and on as an adult, and those were not the best times of my life, although it filled my soul in a weird way. But somehow it lives in my brain, and I miss it a lot. This is complicated by the fact that most people in my current city see it as a tourist destination, an idyllic place where everyone is outdoorsy, historic, cute, and, quote, not real. So I don't talk about it much, or I'm forced to hear about ski trips to resorts that underpay my childhood friends and adorable Airbnbs that made the rental market all but impossible for many of my neighbors, or a bunch of, wow, people actually XYZ? It was so cute. I've only seen that on TV. Is there a way that I can stop thinking about this so often from my stable job in a city I also love, where I have a life I wouldn't be able to build there?
I was reading this going, oh my God, just say where it is.
Right.
It was driving me crazy not knowing where the place was. I ended up asking people on Twitter what they thought. And got a lot of votes for Vermont and West Virginia, a few votes for Asheville, North Carolina, and an honorable mention for Lake Tahoe, even though I don't think there's an issue with internet access in Lake Tahoe. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The place sounds interesting and challenging. My first thought when I read this, I understand missing somewhere. Crying about it is a lot.
Yes. It is. I mean, I'm from Houston, so it's a gigantic place, but there, to me, aspects are small. So I've battled with this. For me, I left home to pursue a career path that I don't think I, at least for what I wanted, could have done from Houston, at least not at the time. It reminds me of something like, you live in the world as it is, not the one you want it to be. And unfortunately, sometimes these are the things that are beyond our control. In that letter writer's case, trying to create a life, support yourself, and it's just not comparable to what the life that they want back home. I don't think that feeling will ever go away. I think for me, what I ultimately tried to do more of, and I actually wrote about it in my book, is that I actually decided to take time and go home. And for me to deal with what I felt uncomfortable about of my past, and to also kind of appreciate the time there and kind of find my own relationship with the city, I think it's a feeling that'll never go away, but there has to be maybe a way that perhaps it could be something that's just going home more often than you normally do now. also learning to find ways to carry home with you. Because for me, Houston is always home, but I've lived so many other places. And I feel like no matter where I go, I'm a Houstonian. And even coming to LA, for me, it was leaving New York was like the happy medium between wanting to pursue certain things professionally, opportunities that I could really only do here these last few years, and what I miss about Houston, the driving. I think Houston and LA a lot of ways are like, minus the Hollywood aspect with the pollution and traffic and a lot of diversity. The weather isn't as nice. That was my happy medium. Maybe there's a happy medium, not in the current city, but another one, the next. But I just think, you know, I really do understand that because I, you know, I have actually thought since my mom passed going back home. Mm-hmm. And she was the main reason why I wanted to go home more. So why would I kind of want to go back even now? But I just think kind of home is yours. So I do get that. But I think for me, my happy medium is going back home more often and bringing more of home with me wherever I go. It can be physical things, the way I decorate, make sure I carry relationships, you know, all these different things that just feel like I have that bit of spirit with me. And when I physically need to be there to go, if I have the opportunity to, I feel really bad for the letter writer because I truly understand that. It's like you even like the life that you create yourself, but it's ultimately not home because I do think home is really special. But I think it's just like if you can't create the life that you want there, you need to find whatever for you is like that happy middle ground. And right. So maybe there is some other type of like different resolution you can make in the years ahead, if that makes sense.
I thought of you when I read this letter because I just read the essay in your book about moving to LA and kind of getting used to life there. And I also know that you wrote the book during a really challenging couple of years in your life. And yeah. I guess I was wondering, when things were tough for you and you were away from home, did you ever find yourself sort of over romanticizing Houston or dreaming of going home as a way to solve problems that probably geography wouldn't actually solve?
I have done that. And I actually come to learn over time, like your problems follow you everywhere. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I've actually been able to separate to enough extent, like that past and not really associated with the city, and just kind of remember like the good parts of home that I like. When I saw it, I was like, ooh, I get it. And I think kind of the inconvenient truth is that I don't think that pain will go away or that longing. For me right now, I can't go back home the way exactly I want to, but I kind of leave that door open. But yeah, like I said, I just try to bring a little bit of more of home with me everywhere, and especially with my mom gone, for me, even as it's very early, I'm still processing, but I'm trying to remember the parts of Houston that she took me to that I like, and what those feelings that I had. You know, for me, I'm always probably gonna cry about it now, but I would say, like, you don't necessarily have to always cry about not being home anymore. I think that's something you can work on, but that longing will always be there. I just think you have to kind of figure out ways that you can better attend to it so that you don't miss it so much and that you can truly enjoy the place that you're in now.
Yeah, I remember reading a book about dream analysis as a teenager. And the one thing I remember about it was that you're not supposed to take your dreams literally as far as right. The people, the characters, and what happens. It's more about what does everyone represent? And that sort of popped into my head when I read this, thinking it can't really be all about the geography of the place, right?
Yeah.
Because that already, you've tried to live there and it didn't go that well for you. So I wonder if there's some thinking you can do about what does this place represent to you? What's the feeling you once had when you were there that you want back? What are the relationships that you had there that you may be missing now? Who were you as a person when you were there? And is there something about that that you're yearning for right now and that you could try to recreate in a physically different space?
Yeah.
I also think, like you said, I love the idea of bringing the place with you, especially with technology, that's very possible. Right. So I grew up in Mill Valley, California, a cute little town outside of San Francisco. And I don't live that far from it now, but I did join a Facebook group called Mill Valley Kids. It has turned out to be mostly boomers reminiscing on growing up there and asking if their old classmates are still alive. And they also had a reunion where they were really celebratory of our retired racist high school mascot. So anyway, it's not for me exactly, but it also includes a lot of beautiful pictures of the views and the scenery and stores that used to be there and people sharing memories. So I say all that to say maybe there's some kind of a group or community around this place or people who grew up there that you could somehow tap into.
I love that.
And yeah, I like your idea too about trying to go back more often. That's a really practical and really good idea. And I wonder if it would take some of the intensity down to go back and realize, okay, it's a place. It has its pros and cons. It's not totally magical. I'm not a different person. It's just a place. And I can be who I want to be where I live now.
Because I would say the homophobia part, that's necessarily threw me for a loop. But I usually go first with racism because to me, racism is everywhere. And even though I'm from, you know, I guess the Confederacy, New York and LA to me have been the most racist places I've ever lived. And I actually experienced homophobia more outright in New York than I did in Houston. But those things are something, I generally, I got the point that they meant, but you do have to go where you feel safest, ultimately. And I think homophobia can truly be a gamble, but yeah, just go home more often, like what you like about it, and then appreciate certain, sometimes, unfortunately, those types of reminders, like, you know what, let me, to your point earlier, don't romanticize this place too much.
Exactly.
I'm where I'm supposed to be now. I just need to figure out how to square the two.
You're listening to the Dear Prudence Show, and when we come back, we'll be reading more of your letters. Stay with us. Welcome back to Dear Prudence. I'm here with my guest, Michael Arsenault, to answer your letters, and the next one is titled, Not a Side Piece.
I, 30 years old, am in love with my former coworker and now friend, who's 29. And this shouldn't be a problem, but he has a girlfriend he lives with. I found out earlier this summer and decided that I would leave him alone. Then he tells me that he's in love with me twice. One of the times was at my birthday party. I told him that as much as I like him, he needs to leave his current partner because I don't want to be a side bitch. Just to be clear, nothing happened beyond intense homoerotic tension. He agreed he would let me know if things changed. My name's day party is coming up, and I invited him. I had no idea why I did it, and I don't know why I persist in liking someone who's dumb enough to confess loving me twice while having a partner. Do I need therapy?
Okay, Michael, so I did not know this until I read your book, but you wrote in I Finally Got Some Jordans about how you used to write an advice column.
I did, like a year, yeah.
It was called Dearly Beloved.
Yes.
And after I read about that, I went and looked it up, and I actually found a piece of advice you gave to someone in a different situation, but a similar one, in that they were pining for a person who was totally unavailable. You said, "Believe me, I know what this is like, but trust me when I tell you that it only ends with you continuing to suffer before ultimately being heartbroken about something you've never had. In fact, I want you to do two things for me. Get rid of this dude and turn on Mary J. Blige's The Love I Never Had. Move on and find something that's truly yours." I feel like we could copy and paste it right here.
Yes. Oh, wow. Also, I'm glad that's up because for a while, all of those columns were gone. So
I found one.
Resurrection. Technically not a side bitch, but already an emotional side bitch. And actually the copy and paste. Yeah, I get it, but no. And to be fair to the letter writer, he might actually love you. He might actually mean those feelings, but he's in a committed relationship with someone else, a woman.
Right.
There could be a lot behind that. I don't know the labels, et cetera, but it feels a little, I know this, I know that story. I'm going to say that. Leave that situation alone. I don't know if you need therapy, but I know you need to leave that alone because literally the longer it goes on, the more painful it will be. Unless that person wants to end the relationship that they're in now and you live with them. Honestly, that's no, run. Please run.
I would just add that you should run because it's not going to end well, but also because you're 30 years old and you don't want to waste too much time emotionally caught up with someone who is not going to be your person. Because every moment, every week, every month you spend focused on this and putting all your energy on this situation is a moment that people who are actually compatible with you and actually prepared to love you could be passing you by. So you really need to be in the habit of kind of clearing the decks as quickly as possible when things don't work out to make room for what you actually do want.
I should have wrote you 10 years ago when I was 30. I'm about to be 40, so I could have used that. Yes, honestly, don't be me. Please listen to her.
Yeah, the years fly by. You got to keep things moving. If you do, it sounds like you want to find a partner who you love and who loves you back. The only thing I'd say different, Michael, yes, I say they absolutely need therapy. You said, I don't know. I say absolutely yes, not because you're making a dumb decision here, but because almost everyone should be in therapy. It can't hurt. It can only help. Even if you're making all the right choices, life is still going to be hard. There are still going to be things that you can look at differently that will feel lighter and easier and more joyful if someone's helping you think through them. So if you have access to therapy, there's absolutely no reason, if the copay is reasonable, that you're not doing it every week or two.
I agree. And if you can find someone that at least, it doesn't necessarily have to be queer, but mm-hmm. someone who understands that as much as visibility might convince some people otherwise, it is still very difficult to be
right.
an out person, which kind of creates more of these situations than there should be.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a genuine, and it has been for several years, rising anti-queer and trans tide, and that mm-hmm. does impact a lot of people's choices. So while that is unfortunately something you can't control, you can control how you deal with these types of circumstances. And I do think a therapist who understands those sensitivities that just generally would be helpful. That's also something I wish I did sooner. Might have saved me some time from being the sad Mary J. Blige album.
This is Dear Prudence. We need to take a break, but when we come back, more letters from you and advice from us. Stay tuned. I'm Janae, and you're listening to Dear Prudence. Michael and I are about to tackle our last question for the day. Michael, are you ready?
I am very ready. This is fun.
The letter is titled, Trying to be Understanding.
I'm 32, and I've always remained friends with my exes. I broke up with Mary last year. We were a couple for 2 years, and we stayed in touch and remained friends. Recently, I discovered that Mary slept with my brother, Rob, after we broke up. I was extremely upset about this, especially when I learned it wasn't just one time. They were sleeping together for several weeks. Mary said it shouldn't matter, that this happened after we were no longer a couple. She wanted us to continue being friends and said it would be unfair if I cut her out of my life since I'm friends with all my other exes. She also said it didn't matter how many times she slept with Rob and said it's not fair that I'm not angry at my brother, only at her. I actually am angry at him, but I have to admit that I'm angrier at Mary. Does Mary have a point? I feel people should be friends with their exes and have made a point to remain in the lives of my exes as friends. I think it's immature to ghost people or cut them out of your life because a romantic relationship ended. But I've also never been in this situation before. Normally, I would talk about this conundrum with my best friend, but that's, you guessed it, my brother Rob.
I ran out of time preparing for this episode, and all my notes say under this is no.
No.
And I guess I just meant no. I mean, no, you don't have to stay friends with your exes. No. All this stuff about unfairness, your love life is not a case before the Supreme Court. You don't have to let anyone else weigh in on what's fair, what's just, what's reasonable. This is your life. This is how you feel. There aren't rules except you trying to be a happy person. Why are you listening to this input? No.
After I stopped being stuck on the brother aspect of it all,
right.
I did go back to the idea, like, you're immature for not. Okay, I am gay man of my demo, situationship king. However, while I do have friends that believe, they're usually friends, one of my best friends in particular is like pretty much cool with all of his exes. I think that's mm-hmm. great, but for the most part, no. I think you, oh my God. I'm supposed to tell you. For one, you don't need to be friends with everyone you dated or had a relationship with. That is not a prerequisite to maturity or anything other than a lot of conversations that you, relationships that you just don't necessarily need to have. But also, I'm sorry. Mary is not your friend.
No.
Deal with your brother, but Mary is not your friend.
Not at all.
Mary does not have a point. You need to let go of this idea that you need to be friends with everyone, much less exes. Run from Mary. Join right. the jog that we just said to the other letter writers and join them. Like, run away from these situations. I still cannot believe.
The nerve.
Yeah,
the nerve of Mary. The audacity of Mary.
2 years, then the brother, 4 weeks, and then they're mad at you for feeling a way about it. And you actually feel guilt about this. No.
No. Sometimes when I read a letter like this, I worry about the specific situation that's being described, but also the letter writer's willingness to be a doormat, to put other people's yes. feelings over their own, to not trust their own intuition, to be more concerned with this, again, this arbitrary set of rules and expectations than making the decision that aligns with your feelings and could lead to a happier life for you. There's no like certificate ceremony at the end of life where you get presented with an award if you've been really mature and stayed right. friends with people who did terrible things to you. That doesn't happen. Stop trying to earn your gold star in that department.
I'll be in the doormat. Also, I'm sorry. I hope you got some words for Rob. Y'all need to talk about it.
Right.
Rob is your brother's foul. I'm sorry. Someone needs to get rid of Mary.
Yeah, I hope you have someone else to talk to besides Rob, because yeah, Mary's not your friend and your brother Rob is not your best friend, or he can't be for much longer. You need a new best friend.
I'm like, I know this isn't Mary J. Blige, but this actually sounds like Sam Mary too. Like, wow.
It's a bad situation, and it's just the kind of situation where I wish we could get 50 people to call in and echo what we're saying, because I feel the letter writer is so down a hole of self-doubt.
Yes.
And not believing that she deserves to be treated well, that I want them to hear repeatedly, this is a shocking situation. That's not, don't even question yourself. Don't even think about it. Get away from both these people. You're not being mean. You're a good person.
At all, because I'm like, ghosting people isn't the best thing in the world. But also sometimes you're never going to get closure with someone and just leave them where they are and run. If you blocked Mary, I get it. I would
Me
never
too.
Talk to Mary again, other than maybe to, you don't even need the apology, but to accept an apology maybe and still let Mary go on their way. I'm good.
Don't let Mary gaslight you. You're under no obligation to remain friends here at all whatsoever. Okay, those are all the questions we have for this week. It's been fun and hopefully helpful. Thank you, Michael.
I hope I've been useful. Thank you for having me.
You've been very useful. I feel like we got you smiling during this episode.
Yes, you did.
So that makes me happy. Follow Michael on Instagram and Twitter at Young Cynic. That's Young, S-I-N-I-C-K. And make sure to read his hilarious and insightful book of essays, I Finally Bought Some Jordans. Do you need help getting along with partners, relatives, coworkers, and people in general? Write to me. Go to slate.com/prudy. That's slate.com/PRUDIE. The Dear Prudence column publishes every Thursday.
If you'd like to hear your question answered on the podcast, we are looking for letter writers who will be comfortable recording their questions for the show. You can stay anonymous.
Dear Prudence is produced by Sierra Spragley Ricks and me, Janae Desmond Harris, with a special thanks to Maura Curry. Editorial help from Paola De Verona. Daisy Rosario is senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. I'm your Dear Prudence, Janae Desmond Harris. Until next time.